So I actually think for the next 5 years, AI is going to deeply affect us, but it actually won't be that noticeable. It's plumbing, right? Your phones are going to get way better. When you're on a foreign holiday, language barriers are just going to evaporate. But it's kind of trivial versus, I think, the very impactful stuff that will come subsequent to that.
Okay.
Towards the end of the 5 year period, it'll be kind of obvious that's all happening. So ultimately, I think we'll see a subtle change where the plumbing of the world is getting re-engineered. Like if you look what Outman's really doing, we're trying to make the plumbing that gives you clean, factual books where it's hands-free and you don't even notice it's getting generated on your behalf.
It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through those milestone moments. Deciding to commit to the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Hey, quick heads up. If you're still in Windows 10, you need to know it's going out of support this October. That means no updates, no patches, just risk. Nostra can help. They're offering free upgrade consultations for businesses right now. Hit the link in the episode description. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code VOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code VOX20 and elevate your marketing game today.
Welcome to the pod, lads.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. We can only start in one place. It's not your fundraising. What's this document you alluded to as we were having coffee there?
Yeah. I suppose I started researching nutrition and health a couple of years ago and started doing weird things. If anyone's wondering, Gary was asking us about what we had for breakfast this morning, and my breakfast was strange enough that it provoked more questions. So basically, I suppose the way I look at it is, and I've gotten this from other clever people, it's that ultimately we're running a marathon to do something like Outman, okay? So I started doing all this when I was around 26 and I was working in like my first proper business. And what I understood was when you're working those hours, when you're trying to execute at a high standard at all times, it's a marathon. And I don't mean in like influencer nutritionist or, you know, something like that. But I mean, like, if you want to be mentally sharp, if you want to turn up and just bounce out of bed every morning, ready to go, et cetera, you have to commit to a certain way of living, right? So that translates into a lot of weirdness when you go into the research. So just be very honest with you. I have a document called Cheat Death Like Ross that I share if I like you. I share it with you.
Okay.
David's read it.
You'll like me by the end. I am a big fan of longevity. I love Brian Johnson. I'm big on I did a video last week on the Whoop, the new Whoop MG, and it was giving me 9.3 years younger than I am. So yeah. I'm all in. So break it down for me. If you're interested in the business section, skip on in a while. But if you're interested in longevity and performing like an athlete, stay with us. Go for it.
Yeah, well, it's basically like to take all the key stuff off the table nutrition-wise first thing in the morning, right? So since I've been 26, every single morning, a big plate of raw vegetables, okay? So broccoli, carrots, you know, celery, whatever in season, and same blueberries, kiwi. And again, all like whatever science says is the best for you. You get a lot of fiber, you don't get sugar spikes during the day, so on and so forth. Then I do...
What time?
around 8 a.m. or so. Nothing crazy. Like, I don't, you know, and, but sorry, before I've done that, I will have gotten up and done. So I do something every single day, right? So if I'm feeling sorry for myself, if I'm sore, if I was out the night before, I just do yoga and that's it. Okay. If I'm feeling good and the weather is bad, I'll do like 20 minutes, very intensive HIIT in my living room, like not going to a gym or anything like that, because I just, it's actually an Arnold Schwarzenegger thing. Don't think, don't make it hard, right? If you think for a second, you won't do it. If you enable yourself to have an excuse, you won't do it. So I do it in my living room. I jump straight out of bed, straight down, exercise. And I can shred myself in like 20 minutes where I can barely stand, can barely. And again, it's just what you want, right? And then if the weather's nice, I'll go for a jog. And then, you know, ever no more than yourself with the Whoop. I'm on Fitbit Charge 6 over here. So again, it's constantly quantifying, right? So you know, making sure my VO2 max is at a good standard. Then I was just saying to David before the show that I was actually thinking of going for a few drinks on Saturday night. I looked at my sleep results from the previous week and I was like, nah, I got to sleep tonight. I need a really good sleep. I'm not going for any pints. So ultimately, I mean, I think they're the core. Sorry, I should say, because this is strange as well. I take like 14 biosuitable supplements every single day. So like a plate of pills.
Okay.
Pretty much every
single day. What are you
taking? The Brian Johnson. So I take krill. So my big thing is about biosuitability. Right.
What is that?
So basically that it has to come from. So if you look at chemical derived supplements, and that maybe I'm straying into influencer territory here, but the big thing about supplements is a lot of them pass straight through your body. I think that the running joke is it's a great way to get very expensive urine is take lots of supplements. So basically, you basically have to take stuff from natural sources because your body's used to absorbing it that way. So what are the vitamin sets that your body, science says your body actually absorbs rather than passes? Okay. So for that reason, like I take krill oil, I take mushroom supplements, I take glucosamine from shellfish, I take hydrolyzed collagen also from, you know, like fish and things of that nature. I take probiotics. What are the other things that I'm on? I take milk thistle as well. So, but yeah, a large for, and then I take just a general multivitamin tablet as well, just to make sure there's no nutritional gaps. Interesting thing is, in spite of all the talk about passing, you're not assimilating the stuff. There's actually a lot of research now that says if you're on a supplement regime, you tend to have a health span approximately 3 years longer than someone who is not. I really enjoy living. So, you know, I'd like to be as active in the world as I can for as long as possible. And all I feel like when I go in for a medical, like with Keyman insurance, you have to go in for medicals and all of that. But all I say is when I go in for that stuff, I get the doctors tend to ask me, what are you doing? What's up? You're full of energy every day. I like to think I can think clearly every day. I'm able to be present for my family, active for them after doing a long day's work and stuff like that.
What's the rest of the diet for the day?
So first of all, no takeaways only on weekend. I avoid meat during the week. Like I like meat, but I, you know, so ultimately make my own sandwich every day, or my partner's very kind. She sometimes makes me a sandwich. We do home cooked meals every day. The biggest meal is in the morning with that giant plate, light lunch, very light dinner, everything home prepared. My wife and I are both good cooks. She does most of the heavy lifting, to be fair to her. But ultimately then it's like really well sourced food. So like we go to all the farmers markets, we make sure, and I came from the food industry. Like I started out in the food industry, and even in my house growing up, my parents were, and it's a funny thing that we say about Outmen now, that the food industry has in common. So what my parents used to say was the more times a person touches food, the worse it is for you. And then sort of my 21st century version of that is the more times a human touches a piece of data, the worse it is for you as well.
What are the key things in your Don't Die document? If people are listening to this, what are the three key things they should be considering doing?
Consistency. Turn up every day, right? You have to commit, right?
So what, to what?
To basically having that clean life, like good nutrition, and just something. Right? You do a little bit every day, right? If it's fads, if it's stop start. And the other thing I would say is I didn't start like this, right? You have to increment in. Okay. So
if you put a plate of raw vegetables in front of you today, you will not be able to eat it all, right? So basically, I started with like bits of broccoli. Then I graduated to the carrot, then broccoli, carrots. And so effectively, that's what I would say is try to introduce it slowly over time. Don't say, oh, 1st of January, I'm a new person, here we go. And then it's just simple stuff that everyone knows, but not everyone applies, right? So get food from good sources. Try to avoid anything out of a packet. And then you have to do a little bit of exercise every single day. Whenever anyone sees me doing it and asks me how I'm so committed that I'm even doing it on weekends and stuff like that, all I ever say is, if I could pull out how I feel at any point in time and inject it into another person, feeling that good is really addictive, right? So ultimately, you become a bit of a sissy, I suppose. I can't handle feeling bad. So I'm always pursuing that feeling, right? So ultimately, it's very simple things applied rigorously, consistently over time, but then equally introduced slowly over time if you want to go on the journey.
Okay. You buying into Kool-Aid?
I like to think that I'm quite healthy and I am very active. Like, exercise is something that like I feel I nearly have to do every day.
What do you do?
I do a bit of a mix. So I go to the gym to lift weights, not bodybuilding anymore. So just kind of, you know, strength, high rep kind of things. I play paddle. I play five-a-side football. So they're my evening activities after the kids are in bed. But then I'll generally go to the gym 5 to 6 mornings a week. If I'm tight for a bit of time, I've a few kind of loose weights that I'll do at home. And then stretching. So try and stretch numerous times a day. Even some mornings, like this morning, I only had about 20 minutes. So I was basically stretching. But like the repetition or the feeling of the fact that you've gone and done it, right? It's just checking that box. You feel like your day can get off at a good, in a good way. And if I don't go, or if I don't do anything, I just feel that I'm not operating, you know, at the full capacity on that particular day. I like to think that I'm quite healthy. Like, I eat fruit in the morning. I do take a fruit smoothie as my breakfast. And I've had Darren on. I take Wholesup in the morning, in the kind of mid morning.
Shout out Wholesup. Shout out Darren.
Group legend. Brilliant. It's actually brilliant, brilliant product. I've
big fan of him.
Tried numerous versions of that. So of those types of products in the past, never stuck with any, and now I feel like can't actually. I've got every 3 weeks my Wholesup arrives, and if I'm it's literally down to the day, and if I feel if I'm missing it for a couple of days, like I'm like where is it, like, you know, so I'm quite dependent on it actually. But generally live clean. I've got young kids, so get a few pints here and there, but it's generally try to go to bed reasonably, get up early for everybody, and be kind of clean living.
Consistency. Yeah. So you guys are building a longevity startup, right?
Next company.
Because if you're not, you should be.
Yeah. Yeah.
People are like, we're 10 minutes in, Gary. We have no idea what these guys do. See, got you listening.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, we've got a company called Outman. And so Outman is an AI bookkeeping platform for businesses and accounting practices. So bookkeeping has always kind of been, or it is this kind of manual, arduous, expensive task for businesses, which they, you know, typically don't like to do, but it needs to be done, right? And then for accounting practices, who provide, mainly those who provide bookkeeping as a service to their clients, it's kind of seen as a loss leader. In order for them to kind of get business in, that they can make their money on some of the higher value services that, you know, that they provide to their clients. So I guess our view is that in order to fully automate bookkeeping, the whole infrastructure that, produces financial data needs to be rebuilt. So that's why we've rebuilt the general ledger system from scratch. We use a combination of AI, standards kind of software integrations, like coding bits of software, and humans in the loop to basically take all of the activities off of our clients and deliver them kind of, clear and, you know, really clean, kind of clean data sets so they can go and do whatever it is. So really in the accounting world, that means producing kind of like trial balances, that kind of stuff. So yeah, we've like 350 customers across Ireland and the UK. We've a bunch of accounting partners now. So yeah, it's going well.
Ross, did some news recently.
Yeah, no, we're very happy. We've some wonderful new partners. We've been back to, so ultimately, like, it's again, like overnight success after 5 years type of thing. So I think we've been selling for 4 years, but we've been coding for 5 years. Okay. And to David's point, like ultimately when we look at bookkeeping, it's like no one gets up in the morning to do bookkeeping, right? So it's what we call like a toothbrush task. I don't think anyone bounces out of bed because they get to brush their teeth, but you have to do it. It's avoidable. It's unavoidable. So ultimately, I suppose we had this vision where we set out with a lot of domain expertise. Like we have an incredible CTO who's deeply experienced in data science and machine learning. And then my previous business was a machine learning business. Then obviously I had the accounting background as well. Okay. So ultimately, what we saw was at the beginning of the business was people were trying to basically put a layer on the past or basically put like really nice software over infrastructure that data science didn't really exist when that infrastructure was built. Okay.
Like what?
So if you look at like Xero or QuickBooks, if you look at Expensify, if you look at like standard payroll software, tax preparation software, things of that nature. So there's like, with every admin on board, we displace 10 to 16 different things where a thing can be a piece of software or an external human or an internal human employee, okay? And ultimately, our argument was that array was designed to optimize people. You know, you saw these SaaS structures where they sold seats to optimize human beings mm-hmm. rather than selling hands-free outcomes. So ultimately, like, we're not just going against software budgets, we're going against software and labor budgets to deliver the outcome that 10 to 16 thing array used to deliver. So I suppose the big news or what you're alluding to is that when we began, we said if someone knew how to automate bookkeeping, it would already have been done, right? So we didn't want to go out and say, we're going to automate bookkeeping, we know how to do that. So what we argued was, we're going to sell fast, cheap accounting, right? But within a structured environment, okay? So ultimately, the MVP of Outmin was a data science pipeline that very finely measured all the workflows, the document acquisition, like the transformations, everything that goes on to deliver a reconciled trial balance, okay? So then the bet was that how you automate accounting or bookkeeping, and then what industries lend themselves to automation initially, or the quickest to be automated, right, would actually present itself in the data rather than any of us making a decision or predict. And actually, funnily enough, so that my prediction was the industry I predicted would be the easiest to automate ends up being one of the hardest to automate.
Which was?
Tech startups and scale-ups. My intuition, which is wrong, was that because everything was already digitized, it would in fact be easy to automate them, right? But the big thing about data science that a lot of people forget is that data science hates variation or variability, right? So the funny thing is what the difference between tech startups and scale-ups versus traditional businesses like hospitality, retail, manufacturing, things of that nature, is that they've way more variability in suppliers, in system provision, and in end-use reporting, okay? So we just made a bet that we were going to get lots of data in a proper data science grade format, okay? And ultimately, so this isn't a notion of earning the right to release science fiction products rather than just sticking a science fiction layer over the past, if you like, okay? So I suppose the reason why the fundraising was, obviously that's always big news, right? And we raised $4 million with a brilliant investor called Praetora leading the round, who has deep domain expertise in the type of work we're doing, which is basically machine learning automation, primarily with agentic workflows, okay? So ultimately what they saw was we've done all the measurements. And again, classic engineering principle, measure twice, cut once, okay? So we've gotten our deep array of measurements. And we're ready to just basically shoot for the stars with the science fiction from here. It's a question of execution and building. So, you know, we're less excited, I suppose, about the fundraising. And we actually have an internal cultural point that we don't celebrate fundraising. And we're more excited about the impact we're going to have on our customers over the next 12 to 18 months. Because to give you a, I suppose, a bite-sized one, we've basically invented a combine harvester for bookkeeping. Okay.
Yeah. So there's an analogy I can get.
Yeah. I think the
we've all watched Clarkson's Farm.
We can get it. I think to Ross's point around like we, the other really interesting thing, obviously, for yes, it's the outcomes for our customers, right? But and I think that's gonna be massively positively impacted by the fact that like we actually have a roadmap now that we know that how to fully automate bookkeeping from here. So really now it's about properly resourcing our kind of software engineers and our tech team to you know execute on that roadmap as quickly as we can, because you know, we're at a point where we've got so many learnings from doing, you know, and eating crap and getting punched in the face, whatever, for the last few years. And that now we actually really understand how to do this and how we can actually bring it from where it is now to, you know, kind of a, an industry changing product, because it's never been done before. Right. So, it's just a really exciting time for the business.
Well, that's the experimental nature of business, right? That's what I keep talking about, people, is that like people put so much pressure on themselves and assumptions. You don't know what you don't know. I say this every episode. Yeah. I say people are sick of the two things I say. You don't know what you don't know, what you have to say to be it. But like, how can you know? Like, you assume tech startups, like that makes sense. When you said that to me, I'm like, yeah, I can see how that would make sense. But then when you said manufacturing, hospitality, that is what it is every single day of the week and has been for the last 20 years. So I got that then. But like, if you had said that to me without the context of the traditional industries, I would have agreed with you. Mm-hmm. At what point did you realize that wouldn't work?
Well, so, and here's the magnificence of this. I didn't. I got told by my CTO, who knows way more about data than I do. And again, it's one of the things we've always said, and it's classic scientific method, right? I had a hypothesis. Right. And I knew the hypothesis is probably directionally correct. And I know deep domain expertise seems to have gone out of fashion culturally. Right. But ultimately, a deep domain expertise in finance and accounting, and then also in machine learning and data science across, you know, two or three different businesses. So all of the learnings from that lived experience told me this was possible. OK. And then ultimately, what I didn't know was how you would go about doing it. Right. So what I felt then was ultimately I needed to get a giant data set in the correct manner and then get someone clever like our CTO, Jane, to tell us what it all means and what it implies we should build. Okay. So that's pretty much how we view the way. So ultimately I have my ideas, right? And then I get as much triangulation, verification of reality as I can. And then you ultimately have to go with what triangulated reality tells you. And I think the more you go against that, the more trouble you tend to run into. Like, you can have a good run for a while, but I think if you want to build a long-term, sustainable, profitable business, you don't have that tight reality tether. You're not triangulating and going exactly the way triangulated information tells you. You're going to fall on your face at some point in the future.
Yeah, but it still surprises me how many people that you see coming out of the gates, particularly in the US, where people that are kind of notional competitors of ours, they, you know, raise a big pile of cash. They spend a couple of, you know, years in stealth mode, they're, you know, in building, and then they come out to the world and then it's like, what are you doing? Well, we're going to try and automate bookkeeping for tech startups and scale-ups. We're like, lads, like, you clearly...
Let me save you another next 10 million.
Yeah.
But I think that's the beauty of being, not having a huge ego, being able to test and learn. And like, this has not been quick. This is 5 years. Like, so this is, you know, as you said, an overnight success. Like, but this is what all good businesses do. They evolve. And when you saw the AI wave coming, because you were way before this, like, AI is what? 18 months?
Are we? See, it's fascinating, right? So this is, if you haven't been, so I was, my first...
Say gen population, right?
Yes.
We're speaking of general population here. Ever knew AI, science fiction, machine learning, maybe a wee bit. But like, AI is all people can talk about for the last 18 months.
18
is
months.
It? Yeah. Give or take?
Yeah. I'll give you a funny one. We built the first version of the website, right? I had to remove the letters AI off the website because people like, don't really know, that's scary. Like, I don't want my financial data, you know, AI near my financial data. So we actually took it off. Then when, you know, the release of ChatGPT and so on. And it was suddenly like everyone's an AI entrepreneur, which is funny.
Yeah. And even like one of the big things we found is like customers couldn't care less about AI.
There you go.
They care about value generation, right? So ultimately, you know, if we're using all the, and like you can do some cool stuff and it's fun, but what I always argue, it's like a 21st century Newton's cradle on your desk. It's like a toy rather than a value generator. Okay. So our goal, and then you see the sad reality is, so like, don't get me wrong, like it's transformative. I think it's a paradigm shift. I think it is going to change society significantly, perhaps not as described or as, you know, people think. But ultimately, what we saw was an incredible enabling technology, right? And I suppose I was a bit lucky that I was working in data science and machine learning since 2015. And I think even with that business, we probably built some tools that were worth more than the business because the tooling did. When I look at the tooling people have today, I'm like shocked, right? But then the big thing was like when we started coding in 2020, I knew what a generative transformer was in 2020, right? And that's obviously the underlying technology that's enabled a lot of the LLMs and it's been improved and refined. But, and I suppose earlier in my career, I was very lucky. I got involved with a think tank in Silicon Valley called Singularity University that, in fact, you know, one of the people who's been predicting this consistently is a guy called Ray Kurzweil. And I haven't seen him in years, but like I know Ray and got to see exactly from the horse's mouth where he thought it was all going. And back then, like a lot of my friends who were also in technology thought he was crazy and would sort of laugh about it. Whereas now actually it's showing his predictions are coming true ahead of time. Mm. Okay. So ultimately, I suppose what we saw was where this technology works best is actually on really boring, repetitive stuff. Okay. It's not a lot of sizzle there. It tends to be quite niche, domain specific and things of that nature. So we understood that those are the things you want to focus with the initial automation wave. And I think the thing you have to be careful of, you have to take on a proper challenge because the foundational models are improving at crazy pace. And again, all ahead of schedule. Like if you look at the rate of change and the curves, you know, showing the various benchmarks, they're all way ahead of schedule. Okay. Now, again, the impact of that is not as people are predicting, right?
What do you mean?
Well, so I suppose people immediately thought, you know, we're going to have flying cars and, you know, immortality and all that. And it's just not really how it works. Like there's a huge amount of inertia in enterprise, in corporate circles and things of that nature. So what I mean is like, if you look, I don't want to be bad. If we just look at Microsoft, right? So Microsoft missed cloud technology and they missed mobile. Okay. Didn't matter because there was so much inertia with their enterprise customers that they were able to have billions in revenues while missing the two biggest technology cycles of the last 20 or 30 years, right? So so ultimately, but then they went big with AI because they successfully invested in OpenAI, right? So ultimately, what we see is we live in a bit of a bubble, right? Like I'm on all the Reddit boards. Most of my friends are in technology. I'm constantly talking tech with people, right? So then I suppose the human at the top of the Gaussian curve, they're way behind those impacts, right? And a lot of stuff that's intuitive to us, the secondhand for us, it can take a long time for that actually to get to the mainstream. And then when you try and implement it in a big, complicated organization, implementation's bloody, like ideas are easy. Implementation's bloody hard.
This is my whole gut feeling on AI, exactly what you summed up there. Like technology comes fast, but the adoption is slow. What will happen in the next 5 to 10 years? What are we going to see? Because there's so much hype, and I'm very careful not to talk too much about it because a lot of it's absolute nonsense. Even when you read like a deep dive in the Financial Times and you're like, yeah, there's nothing in that. There's absolutely nothing new in that. That's just repeating ChatGPT. It's going to automate everything, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I don't see the solution, which you correctly said there, the solution or the real impact in my day-to-day life. So what are we going to see for the average person impact day-to-day life in the next 5 years?
A fascinating question. And like, I'm going to get this wrong, right? But I will tell you what I think.
Doesn't matter. We'll redo it in 5 years. We'll clip this, play it in 5 years. But no one knows. But I'm keen to talk to people who have more insight than the general population, because most of us don't have a Scooby and we're kind of guessing, whereas at least an informed guess is better than no guess.
Well, I think we have interesting corollaries. Okay. So what we see is history tends to recur in different forms. Okay. So when people ask me where AI is right now, I sort of say, I like to use the original explosion to the mass consumer market of the internet as a corollary for AI today.
okay? Where it was like, if you look at internet, mobile, and cloud, it wasn't this. So internet was the big paradigm shift. Internet, obviously, what's enabled mobile and cloud. So I look at internet as this thing on its own, and then it enabled other things. So basically, when I talk about AI, I sort of say it's around 1998 in internet years, okay?
So dial-up.
Yeah.
Around the dial-up era.
But it also means there's pets.com, there's stamps.com, there's Amazon, and there's Google, okay? And so ultimately what we have is we have this incredibly exciting tool, right, that nobody really knows how to productize. When I look at, so GPT is basically a text terminal, right? And I grew up actually with MS-DOS, and the first thing I could code was actually just DOS, right? And I was trying to turn...
Hello, world.
Exactly. No, I was actually just trying to... So back then, you had to boot into Windows, right? You went straight into Windows. It's like Windows 95. And then you'd have to exit out and go into your games, right? So I'd basically be doing stuff like, well, how do I make it go straight into... So I'd make the auto exec back, look up my game directory, and then if the CD game CD was in the CD drive, it'd launch instead of Windows. So that's actually how I got started, right? So ultimately, when I look at GPT today, it's a text terminal, right? And so what I argue is, if we stopped all if all AI development stopped today, we could be productizing these technologies for the next 10, 20 years, okay? And the reason why is, it's an inversion of all computer science to date, right? So if you look at computer science to date, theory was faster than application, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So basically... we would predict, oh, we can do this with C++ and we will get this outcome, okay? Or we'll write these algorithms and these will be the outcomes, okay? So then what actually happens with AI is we just train a model. We don't actually know what it can do until after it's trained, okay? And then like if you look, the first versions of GPT were never trained to code. It was an emergent property, right? So all code to date that wasn't sort of enabled by LLMs, it had an adjacency problem. So if I design a set of software to basically, I don't know, take photos of Gary Fox at specific time intervals during a podcast, okay? And then I ask it to, you know, take a photo of a cat instead, basically completely fails, doesn't work, okay? So the thing about AI technology is we don't know everything it can do. So, and that's the thing, like one of the things they found out years after GPT-3 was released was that through chain of thought reasoning, you can actually make ChatGPT-3 perform to the same standard as ChatGPT-4. Now, they figured that out a long time after they'd actually released the model, right? So sorry, very long-winded way of answering. And then, sorry, then there's these weird catch-alls, right? So I don't know, do you know, there's this famous like 1979 Atari chess program, right? It can beat ChatGPT-4.0 at chess. Okay. So the point is, it's not this linear curve, right? And I know all the exponential curves always have these lovely hockey pucks and all of that, but it's not really how it works. So basically, what all that implies for me over the next 5 years, okay? So first of all, it's going to be plumbing, right? So if we want LLM, and this is part of what Outman actually does, right? If you want AI to interact with the real world, you have to rapidly encode the real world into data science grade information and basically create a feedback loop for the LLM to work with, okay? So I don't think any of the world is really structured like that today. So there's this plumbing initiative that needs to go on. In anything we want LLMs to interact with, we need a really tight feedback loop and lots of data, right? So I think the next, and then to challenge you on something, AI is affecting you right now. You just don't notice, right? So I actually think for the next 5 years, AI is going to deeply affect us, but it actually won't be that noticeable, okay? I think if we look at...
In what way?
So it's plumbing, right? Your phones are going to get way better, right? Just being able... When you're on a foreign holiday, language barriers are just going to evaporate, right? So, but it's kind of trivial versus, I think, the very impactful stuff that will come subsequent to that.
And okay.
Towards the end of the five-year period, it'll be kind of obvious that's all happening, right? So ultimately, I think we'll see a subtle change where the plumbing of the world is getting re-engineered for, like, if you look what Outman's really doing, we're trying to make the plumbing that gives you clean, factual books where it's hands-free and you don't even notice it's getting generated on your behalf, right? So I think if you rinse and repeat that across different industries, that's what you're going to see, right? Then there's going to be a lot of gee whiz gimmicks and stuff like that, right? And I think the big thing that we're going to see, based, I don't know if you know about the Will Smith eating spaghetti benchmark.
No.
So basically how they, the ability to render videos, they just keep asking the prompts to make videos of Will Smith eating spaghetti. And they then benchmark the rate of change of fidelity of him eating spaghetti over the last like sort of 5 years, right? So one of the things that I think is actually going to happen is that in-person conversations and, you know, being able to like meeting people in real life versus screen is going to become more in-person stuff is going to become more and more important, because I think by year five, it will be impossible to tell what's real anymore, right? And then, because the, if you look today, like the state of the art vision models and things like that, like they're incredibly impressive.
So you think, now you got my attention. So you think in 5 years time, if people, if we did this via Zoom, people wouldn't be able to tell where actually was you guys or just AI versions of you if we were doing it virtually?
100%.
Now that's the kind of model I want you to put your line. Put your line in the sand and say, that is what I believe. That's wild.
Ross, so who's going to be the winners and losers here? Who's going to be like, you know, when you talk about AI, who's going to be the winners and losers? Because there's like a lot of doom mongering. I find there's like two extremes. I mean, there's an extremes, you kind of know, like there's a bit, a lot of fluff going on. Who's going to be the massive winner and the massive loser in AI?
It's fascinating. And again, going to get it wrong, right? But it is interesting, right? So one of the things I think about is, so first of all, there's fundamental things that AI won't be able to touch, okay? So I think, and even if you look at, and it's niche stuff, right? So if you look at, let's just pretend if you're into, you know, property renovation or something. So if you're really good at doing like ceiling cornicing or refurbishing ceiling cornicing, okay? Something that, or like refurbishing fireplaces or something like that, right? 100-year-old fireplace, you make it look magnificent again, right? So I think those sort of industries are actually going to become really high skill and really neat. And don't get me wrong, longer term robotics probably gets there, but you're probably talking, you know, 30 years rather than next 5 years. So I think, and then there's the, and I hate to say this out loud, although sorry, we've wonderful solicitors, so I don't mean them, but I think the legal industry actually is, so anything that requires a bedside manner or the human component, okay? Because ultimately, you know, and it's funny the way our senses work. Like, yes, I can get a flawless solicitor saying clever things to you on a screen, right? But if we look, like, this is why, again, the in-person, like, humans respond to touch, smell, like, how you move, your physicality, things like that. So I have a feeling anything that we're, and this is actually where we think accounting's going, like, so we actually think accountants will become, like, a form of business coach, right? Whereby they will be the domain expert on your business, you know, they'll give you insights or work with the machine learning algorithms to really support you in your business, right? And ultimately, like, we can never deliver that, right? Like, you know, all we can give you is, you know, we'll put a personality on the agent or whatever, right? But ultimately, it doesn't come across as authentic. If you want to talk about the bad week, what do I need to do here? We think there's going to be a human component there, right? So that's ultimately where I see it going. And so if you look at restaurants, right? There might be less people in restaurants, but we love the ritual of going out, eating with each other, having a few drinks, having a conversation, okay? I think in-person events, like if we look at like pitch golf or all the dark, and if you look at the next generation, it's all about the experience now. And I think that's great. I actually think that's brilliant, right? I think society is bettered for people wanting to go out and have experiences with each other, you know? And then, but then the big winners, listen, it's going to be the people. So, but it's, again, interesting, right? I think it's going to fall to data and compute, okay? So ultimately, I think if you're creating a unique data set like what we're doing in Outman, like I always argue, we have a financial data set that no one else has on planet Earth because of the work we've done over the last 4 years, right? So I think if you have a data set that no one else has, there's going to be immense value to that, right? Then the other thing we see is compute and inference, right? So even after... One of the things we see, so if we look at the models in and of themselves, DeepSeek R1, but we've actually had versions of this before, even with Llama, as soon as you make some devastating state-of-the-art model, it tends to be a cheap knockoff pretty soon afterwards, right? Now, the irony is you need the state-of-the-art model to make the cheap knockoff. And I think that's, you know, if there was no GPT-4, there was no DeepSeek R1. And that tends to get left out of the conversation a bit, I think. But then, and this is where, like, if you look at Google and NVIDIA, after the model's trained, it's all about inference, right? So ultimately, whoever owns the data the data centers, I think. So the value is basically going to go to compute and to data sets, I think. So if you don't have, and then, you know, you can look at the cast of characters and think, two people with compute, NVIDIA and Google, right? There's a couple of companies making really interesting data sets. I think if you look at the acquisition Meta just did of
Scale AI,
that was a data play. Scale AI have...
What is that?
So basically Scale AI are doing like automated workflows and things of that for enterprise companies, right? So they've all these incredible documented workflows, all the data that go along with the workflows and so on and so forth, right? So ultimately, if that data set doesn't exist elsewhere, and like the internet was scraped a long time ago, so whatever data is on the internet is already in the models, right? So you're looking at data sets that aren't accessible, have been proven to generate value in the real world.
Okay.
Right? And that, again, like talking my own book a bit, like that's exactly what Outman are doing. So
are these big models a threat to you or a benefit?
They are, we couldn't be doing anything without them. Right. But it's so they're a threat if you don't understand how it works and how you need to calibrate your business around the reality of those models. Right. So a few first and we everything I'm about to say, we apply in Outman. OK. So ultimately, if you do. So if you look at SaaS, right, SaaS was always narrow purpose and relatively like if you look at Expensify, take a photo of an expense, goes to, you know, not a very easy to work with backend and the accounts team process it. Right. So the problem with that is it's too easy, right? With the way you can code with machine learning and foundational models now, you can spit that out. And we displaced Expensify. Like we've our own version of that that's vertically integrated into our system that we've designed entirely ourselves. Okay. So what I say is you have to take on something really hard, right? And that's again, if you look, that's why we're looking to automate bookkeeping because it's actually, it seems simple, but it's actually incredibly hard. Okay. So then the other thing is you have to be sure that the stuff you want to do over time is amplified by the machine learning models, right? So what we actually do is we define all our workflows. So how we get an invoice, how we get a statement, how we reconcile that. Before that was ever automated, we had the workflow incredibly crystally defined or crystallized and defined, okay? So then what it enables to do is when a new model emerges, you can A/B test the model's performance versus your human or semi-automated workflow. You don't put in the model until it can beat your workflow on price and accuracy, okay? So what we've actually done is we've all these incredibly exciting plans, including plumbing, including what happens after the plumbings. And basically what you need is that with each subsequent release of a foundational model, your offering is amplified. So if you look what we do today, we give an accounting practice a perfectly reconciled trial balance where neither they nor the client have had to do any work to produce that trial balance, okay? So then we think about there's some devastating like GPT-6 or whatever, right? So then let's just pretend our platform, well, it's not pretend, this is actually true. Our platform enables like an audit firm to do an audit in less than half the time today, okay? So maybe with that model release, we can give another tool that enables them to do the audit in a tenth of the time. Maybe they can do a budget in a tenth of the time. Maybe they can do it in a 20th of the time, right? So what we say, so we have this sort of roadmap that of really hard things that are manual today are tough, but with the correct release of a foundational model becomes automated quite readily. So that's how we do it anyway. We define the workflow. We identify all the hard things that cannot be automated today, on the basis that when there is an improvement, it actually improves your offering really rapidly.
Okay. David, when you went to market for the fundraising, what was the feedback?
So for this current round, it was a little bit different. So it's actually got a bit easier.
That's what I came to hear. How many times have you raised?
I'd say three times.
Yeah. Okay, so kind of talk me through that, because that's what I'm really interested to kind of find is this trend and kind of find out where we are in the world with this.
Well, it's an interesting one. Like, I guess at the very beginning, we approached so in 2020, went down and approached kind of the VC industry. The model didn't make sense to a lot of VCs. It was very different to the typical thing that they would usually invest in. you know, on one hand, we had Ross talking about generative transformers, and I was looking on the other side of the table, and they, you know, a lot of these people didn't really know what a generative transformer was, right? So we also had, you know, the our humans in the loop. They kind of looked at that as a negative thing, where we were trying to talk, we were trying to explain to them how it was positive. So Ross put up the initial capital for the business. We got an angel investor who we both know, and they put up some capital, and we got into the Enterprise Ireland HPSU program. So they matched up the 250k. So that was our first round. We then, following kind of a year and 18 months later, we got backed by Middle Game Ventures. Okay, so as our first kind of I suppose VC investor. So the team there, in conjunction with a firm in the UK called Fuel, plus a family office here in Ireland. So we raised 1.5 million through there, and then in the following year we did another 2 million. So it got easier as we went along, because we were proving, you know, we were proving certain we had lots more proof points basically along the way. Another thing that we did, right, which I think was very beneficial to us, was like we started selling pretty much straight away, right? So we started to go to market. Like we nearly had, like my background is all on the commercial side, right? So Ross is the subject matter expert, I guess, in the context of what we do. My background is typically in kind of sales, the commercial side of tech startups and scale. So we nearly had customers before we had a product. Okay, so because it's going out basically selling the vision with a slide deck, you know, and people had nearly agreed to come on before we were actually ready for them. So as we were generating revenue really early, we're getting feedback. We were, you know, building the data set, which I think was really helped us in when we were going fundraising, because we were on a pretty good revenue was going quite well, right? So that was a big. It was a significant part of the fundraising, and based on the revenue journey, and I guess over time, the you know, our model has become more sexy, right? And it's now, you know, it's very, very acceptable to the investment community to back a model like ours, because they see where things are going.
That's why it's so curious, because timing is so important, right? Mm. And people are, come on, they're like, look, we were struggling away for ages, and then suddenly COVID happened and remote software was cool. You know, so like there's always this element of timing. That's why it's so interesting to hear from your perspective of like the kind of narrative of going through. What mistakes did you make in the earlier stages on funding?
Particularly around the fundraising,
yeah.
Like, look, we make lots of mistakes, right? I guess probably in terms of mistakes, like, I don't know, do you think of like one off the top of your head?
Oh, so you know, initially, I can distinctly remember, you know, I wasn't fully committed when we started, right? Like, I was sort of doing it. It was like a COVID thing, right? Like, I was sort of doing it.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, like, yeah. I was trying to be chair. And ultimately, like, I don't know, like, I was a bit tired and burnt out after the previous business and things like that. And I was sort of dabbling with journalism and things like that. And ultimately, like, I went into the first few VC meetings with David, and was sort of saying, yeah, like, I'm supporting these guys and I'm investing in these guys to execute this thing. And then I would also say, which just meant we didn't get investment. So like when I say I had to put the first money into the business, like one of the reasons is also because we butchered a lot of the initial outreach. Now don't get me wrong. Like it was, so the model that was weird then is now sort of accepted as this is how you do it. Right. So we did have that amount of foresight, but then I would also say is we were going in. Storytelling ape, right? Like humans respond to stories. If we look what makes civilization move, it tends to be stories, right? Mm. So ultimately, you know, I think we were a bit insecure, or we were just trying to be, I think it's just that you find yourself in that pleasing space where you're trying to be all things to everybody, right? So I think we knew exactly what we needed to do and what we needed to build. And I think you're so desperate. And I think this is a very common founder story. You're so desperate for those first customers, for that first bit of investment, right? And if people ask you to do X and Y, you go, okay, and then you extend yourself and you lose focus on the core. And
it was very much a technology story where the bets were coming in. And I suppose that was, I'd done a deep tech company previously. And one of the clever things we did was we managed to generate revenue and get customer feedback while we were still deep tech. Okay. So instead of just being like brutally clear with the investment community from a point of confidence about this is exactly what we want to build, this is exactly the feedback we're getting, right? We would have someone who actually knew less than us say, oh, would you not look at this? And we kind of go along with it, right? Just to...
We're really like trying to look more like a SaaS business.
Because
that's what we knew that they invested in. And that's typically for the last 20 years what they've invested in. So we were trying to shoehorn our model into be a bit of a SaaS, into what looked like a SaaS business. And I think from another thing as well is like, What we've done is a massive undertaking, and it's quite expensive, right? So, you know, we would still argue that like we've done an incredible amount on what is a relatively shoestring budget, even though we've raised a significant amount of capital. People that are doing businesses like these or have the same kind of model as us, you know, will have raised massive amounts of money. So, maybe asking for a little bit more would have been beneficial for us.
I think why I'm asking you that is this is a story as old as time. Mm. Founders will like water down their version. Mm. How do you walk that line, right? Between watering down your version to fit the model that you know is backable and investable now versus no, we are right. If we hold tight, we will get there. But like being early is the same as being wrong.
Sure. But
so how do you walk that line?
I think that's about finding the right investors, right? And I think that like in our most recent round, led by a firm in the UK called Partora Ventures, who, you know, they're a relatively new fund, but they have experience working with portfolio companies who have the same model as ours. They backed a company called Peak AI. In 2019, I think they were their first check-in. Peak have recently exited to UiPath. So when Praetora saw what we had done and the way that we thought about things and the way we'd approach things, they was like instantly got it, right? So maybe if we, you know, maybe some of our fundraising would have been easier if we had come across Peak maybe a year or two ago.
No, I think that's a brilliant point, right? Like ultimately what we didn't do was we were just going and like, we were like brand aware, right? Like we knew who Sequoia were and things of that nature. And obviously we know all the Irish VCs and things like that. So, but David's point was completely correct. Like what we should have done was looked at VCs who had backed companies that look like or understood the approach and take the approach we're taking. Okay. And it's actually hard to figure out who's really doing it behind the scenes, you know? So I think, yeah, if we had found someone that really understood how we were going about our business, we would have done a bit better earlier. Another point I make is that, and a lot of people have this problem, right? And I definitely get like, I'm ultra confident when I've a critical mass of data telling me I'm right. Okay. So one of the reasons it takes a long time to build up a data set that tells you this is definitely how it works. Okay. And longer than I think people admit, right? So ultimately, I think the big difference that we have now is we have so much data telling us exactly what to do that we're pretty confident no one else has. Okay. So that's why when I'm a lot more black and white on what we're doing, why and why we shouldn't do stuff in the last sort of 6 and 12 months than I would have been in any period previous in the business, because I've so much information telling us we're correct.
And whether that's like pleasing like an investor or running around, you know, trying to please a customer that we might never be able to make happy. You know, I think when you build that level of confidence based on the proof and the evidence, things actually become way easier, right? And you're the way you think, like you just got a very clear direction.
But there's Darwinism at play here in terms of it's not the strongest that survive, it's the ones that are willing to evolve, right?
Thank you.
Exactly.
Right. It's not the biggest company. It's not the fastest company. It's not the best funded company. It's the most adaptable company that thrives over time. And even if you look at our life cycle, right? Over the last 5 years, we've had to adapt really, really fast to reality, to what data says. And I'll tell you now, if we didn't do that, when Jane phoned us up and said, hey guys, we should be focused on hospitality. It's the easiest to automate. And we said, no, Jane, like we love all the startup people and it's really easy to get meetings with startups. It's really easy to get them onboarded.
So they're doing nothing all day.
you set up, so Gary, you talk to more of them than we do.
No, I never talk to those ones because they'll never get on the pod because they're doing nothing. Perfect. Cosplaying.
Yeah, no, there is a lot of that, to be fair. And that's a whole other, but yeah, like a strong feelings on that as well. But ultimately it's again, you have to accept the information. And sometimes like we don't want the information coming in, right? And sometimes it really kicks the hypothesis in the teeth, right?
This is what I was trying to tease out of you for earlier stage founders, because I get the same questions over and over. What should we do? Here's our idea. I'm like, I think the idea is pretty bad. You know, marketplace. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get that all the time. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're going to have to fill both sides of the marketplace. Yeah, it'll be quite difficult, blah, blah, blah.
Marketplace businesses are really tough.
Oh, Christ, right? And there, and that the information is out there, but then you're like, I don't want to kick them in the teeth either. But like, there has to be an easier way. Like, how do you advise earlier stage founders to take on that feedback in a more kind of clear and concise way? How can they speed this up?
I think from my perspective, like I'd never done accounting, didn't know anything about bookkeeping. And a friend of mine who had built a successful startup told me, look, you got to speak to 100 people. Don't speak to 100 people who you think will be your potential customers or their stakeholders or their experts in the area. And that's how I got a lot of our first customers. So, you know, like anytime that anyone asks me that question, I'm like, you need to go and speak to a mass of at least 100, like could be 500 people who you think you're building this for and see what they say, right? Get their feedback. You know, about all things, whether it be the problem, you know, the problem you're trying to solve, tools they use today, you know, how much of a pain is it? Because ultimately things just come back to pain. So, yeah, that's how we, and go, if the thing, like when you ask for feedback, right, you know, you might get a customer. If you ask for a customer, you might get feedback, you know, it's so.
Pitbull.
Yeah.
Ask for money, get advice. Exactly. Ask for advice, get money twice.
Exactly. Yeah. So I had a list. I did that. During COVID and people weren't doing anything, but the most successful email campaign I've ever sent in my life, right? Got like I can't remember. It was like 25% meeting booked rate or something, like something off the charts, right? But I basically got the Enterprise Ireland publish who they give their funding to through the HPSU or the, I can't remember the other one, the other program that they had, right? And every year. So I got every founder who was backed by Enterprise Ireland for the last 5 years, it was actually public information. You get their email address. So it's like 500, emailed them all. I got 100 and something meetings out of it. Now, people weren't doing it. It was during COVID or whatever.
What was the headline? Do you want free cash?
I was very honest in it. I said, look, my name is David. We're starting a business. You're the type of person who we're building this for. Here's the kind of problems that we're trying to solve. And like, would you give me 20 minutes of your time just to, you know, to chat through and give me your insights? And people were more than happy to chat. But anytime we do that around, like if we're thinking about something different or I'm launching a new channel or something, I'll always do a version of that. And I think it's a really helpful thing for people, especially at the beginning, because if no one comes back, right, and you're clearly not you know, hitting on a pain point,
yeah,
right, so like there's signal there as well, so I think it's a useful exercise.
That's a really useful, like that 100 people thing I've just written down the note there, that's key, right? What other, so say startups 1 to 3 years in, there's so much weird advice, we'll touch on what you're talking about there, but the cosplaying thing, what's massively overrated in the first 3 years and what's massively underrated in the first 3 years of a startup?
Good question.
Thank you. I've been practicing for 6 years. Eventually I get one or two gems every episode.
Oh no, that's very good. I've never actually thought about that. So what I would say in terms of overrated, okay, like the whole spend a load of money on marketing, get the customers in, figuring out, like I hate that model, okay? And there's a lot of stuff. You raise a load of money, you have a mediocre product, you spend a lot of money on sales and marketing, okay? And it's actually, and even like, it's just like there's big companies that have done that successfully and come out the, like I think Uber are a brilliant example of that, where actually it was rubbish for a long time, it was loss making, things of that nature, but they just had so much backing and support, it's now actually a real business, right? But then the problem is they're a huge outlier, right? And how many people pursue that? And it never works, right?
The exception, not the rule. We talked about it in the lift coming up. Like, people look at the exceptions and think that's the rule, when in reality, the Elons, Patrick Collison, the John Collisons of the world, they're the exceptional outliers.
Yeah, 100%. And there's a brilliant company called or brilliant VC called the Data Collective VC in San Francisco. And they wrote a really interesting book, I'm trying to remember what it's called, but about the statistics behind the reality of successful founders, right? So again, tend to be on your third business in your mid-40s. B2B tends to be the most successful. They tend to have at least 2 to 3 founders, all these sort of statistics, right? So that's the kind of information I mine when I'm figuring out. So then in being underrated, right? What is your verification process as to making decisions in the business? Okay.
And I give me that in simple language. Underrated is.
So how do you decide what the correct thing to do in any given set of circumstances is? Right. So
what do you mean? A framework decision making process? What?
Yeah. So ultimately what we do, if you look at anything we do, right, is there any data to verify what we're saying? Do we actually have a real domain expert saying this? Okay. And when I say a real domain expert, I'm someone who's done it like 2 or 3 times in the commercial world with real customers. Okay. So then if we've one person saying that, do we have an external person with similar experience set with no horse in the race who we can triangulate what the person who we work closely with is saying? Okay. So that's what I always think is, how can I verify this is real? How can I prove this is real? And I have so few people talking about that or asking about that. And even like we've these system, one of the things we've said is we've done the classic, like there's an empty seat for the customer in our exec meetings, right? But we now have a second empty seat, which is for ChatGPT or an LLM, okay? So one of the amazing things we've discovered is that like we can get very entrenched in disagreement, okay? So one of the things we've started to do is, I hate to say, I've actually done this with my wife a couple of times as well. We frame both sides of the argument, right? Each person gets to look at, are you happy that your argument is captured correctly here, right? And then we pump both in and just ask ChatGPT what it thinks. Okay. Yeah. And it's amazing, some of the stuff it provokes, you know? And it just makes for better conversation.
I love it.
Yeah, and I can...
Domestic arguments settled by ChatGPT.
Well, I can give you one. It's pretty gas, right?
Go first.
Mother's Day. Right. So I grew up in a house that Mother's Day was not celebrated. In fact, my mom gets angry if you try and every day is Mother's Day. Why do you need it? You should be appreciating me every day.
Okay. But it's nice. An extra day. Okay.
It's nice to
see where she's coming from. But an extra day is
she's
no
very
harm.
Like that. She does. If you celebrate her birthday, she gets annoyed as well.
It's right? Kind of an Irish thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Go on.
So anyway, because of that, and like, don't get me wrong. So if my wife had meaningfully come to me and said, Ross, you know, I actually culturally, I would like our family to celebrate Mother's Day, and it actually mean a lot to me. And she's great, like, so of course I'd say yes to that, right? But instead, what happens is on Mother's Day, nothing really happens, right? I bring her, you know, make her a latte before she's out of bed, and here you go, you know? But anyway, so...
So you just scrubbed Mother's Day from your...
Like, oh, no, but we always have. But then this year, and in fairness, we have a child now, right? So she's, you know... But anyway, so... But then this year, yeah, just not happy at all. So we've never celebrated it previously, right? So then we put it into ChatGPT.
What is your child?
She's 2 years and 3 months now.
Okay. All right. So it's the first. Yeah. Okay. Right.
Yeah. There, thereabouts. You know, the first year is a blizzard. So she probably wants
to. I'll give you a pass on that, but I'm really curious to see where this is going.
No, but it was fascinating. So it gave back. It basically said, right, this is purely communication, right?
Yeah.
You should have had a conversation about this, and you have to establish your family culture and all this sort of stuff. So then we actually do that now. And we actually talk about culturally, what are the things that are important to us? You know, what are the things we should celebrate? What are the things we want the kids to care about and things? So not only did it settle that argument, it then actually gave us a framework where, geez, we should actually be having this conversation more regularly. We enjoy it. We learn more about each other. You know, we get very clear on what's important for the family. So I actually think it's a great way to do it.
I thought you were going to go off on a wild tangent there. That makes a lot of logical sense.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. David. What do you think is massively overrated in the early stage of business and massively underrated?
I think there's a lot of vanity metrics that people chase in the early start, early days.
So overrated vanity metrics, like what?
Like employee size, fundraise, let's say things of that nature. I think like ultimately, the early stages of business, you need to be laser focused on the problem that you're solving for a specific user or a specific customer. And I think like getting as close as you can to your user or to your customer, right, and really understanding how your solution fits into their way of working, how it exactly it solves the problem, how they interact with it, the feedback, iterating on that feedback, is just so crucially important. And I think that sometimes people can lose sight of that. Like if you're in the early stage of business and you have, who was saying, I heard something recently and it, you know, totally agree with it. Like you're better off having, you know, 100 people that really love you versus having like 10,000 people that kind of like you. Right. And I think if you can focus and get clear on that and really focus on that in the early days of the business, it just sets you up to be successful over time. But I don't hear that many people talking about that.
And then underrated?
Sorry, that was underrated. Sorry, that's I was saying that would be my point for underrated. It's just not really, it's not common or it's not talked about enough in my view. So yeah.
Okay, cool. So as you kind of look ahead in the next kind of like 3 to 4 years for Outman, what would you love to have happened?
Well, what I would love is, so ultimately the future we're trying to craft, right, is that one of the big things we see is like, if you have the best finance function, the best finance team, doesn't make your product or customer experience better. Okay. It can give you information about your product or customer experience that may be useful, but it doesn't actually necessarily enable that improvement, right? So ultimately, every minute you spend worrying about your finance and things like that is a minute not spent on product or customer experience, right? So I think the future we all want is that basically you can pick up your phone and you can ask, what important thing happened in my business yesterday? What important thing happened last week and last month? And you get a factual answer that's completely correct. No hallucination, no nonsense, no nothing. So ultimately, that's what we want to be able, is that if I'm an accountant who runs a practice, if I need to know anything about my customers, if I need to offer advice to my customers, tell them what's going well, what's going bad, I can do it with complete confidence incredibly quickly just by talking, right? If I want to, you know, put together a really impressive chart or performance measure for my client or anything at all, that it just happens instantly with very little work on my side, right? So ultimately, it enables me to be the best guide. If I am a business owner and I have a finance department and all of that, it's the same thing, that the business owner can constantly talk about their business, have, you know, natural language interface about what are the things I need to watch out for, what would a business at my size normally be doing at this, is there anything I'm not doing that a business of my type would be doing at this point in time, and so on. So ultimately we're doing the plumbing today, but I think in 5 years' time, we want the best business enablement tool on planet Earth. It doesn't matter if you're an accounting practice trying to support as many clients to prosper as you can, or if you're a direct customer who, you know, has a restaurant chain, has a food manufacturing plant, something like that, and you're just trying to make a really good product and grow your business, right? So I think that the net or the real goal of this business, and that this is actually one of our first visions at the very beginning, to make it easier to own and operate a business anywhere on planet Earth. And that is the stretch goal.
Good tagline, but you need simple taglines. Like you need to be able to understand. Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem, providing supports, insights, and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets, to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global. Quickfire time.
Uh-huh.
What book would you recommend everyone should read? Start with you, David.
So give you a couple. I know it's come up before, but Shoe Dog, right, is a, I think it's a really easy read, right? But it's also, I think, gives a quite an accurate depiction, particularly the early stages of it, around like what the reality of like reality is like trying to get a business off the ground. And I also, I'll give you a sales book, right? Because I think a lot of entrepreneurs need to be able to sell in some way, right? They're always selling something, right? Even though they might not always understand think that they are. A book called The Challenger Sale. It's my favorite sales book, right? And I think it's quite easily relatable for people that are not you know, in sales. And I think entrepreneurs are able to sell with the talent, the methodology that they give you, because they have a subject matter expertise that they can kind of, you know, teach people about. So yeah, I'd recommend that one for everyone.
Awesome. I have one key book, and then I just recommend two others because of the times we live in. So if I'm correct, and it's like 1998 in internet years, I think the key book to read right now is actually The Everything Store by Brad Stone, which charts Amazon. Okay.
It's a great book.
I think
it's a good story as well.
Yeah, but it rings true, right? And that's what I would say is, like, I read a lot of entrepreneurial books, and you can always see, like, you're getting the myth, not necessary. Whereas even if you look how Bezos described risk rates and, you know, probability of success back then, and even like using, and I know this is a very well understood thing now, but using books as the payload. And again, if you look what he did, there's a corollary to what we're doing as well, whereby he accepted the infrastructure that existed beyond the postal service. It simply wasn't there for what the internet could enable. Okay, so he imagined an entirely different way of ordering and fulfilling goods, okay? And I suppose he used a very simple version to enable it first, right? And I would actually argue Amazon was one of the hardest things to create of all the big tech companies that have emerged. Amazon looks like it has the most moving parts to me, okay? So I actually think in terms of complexity, the complexity he achieved is incredible. And it's just all about how to surf a paradigm shift, okay? Then, because we're just living in an incredibly uncertain time, and it actually calls back to your point in how do you plan for foundational model improvement, okay? On top of all the other things like economic uncertainty that we're facing at the moment and everything as well. So there's two books that I think really help, right? So one is a pretty famous one called Anti-Fragile by Nicholas Nassim Taleb, the guy who wrote The Black Swan. And it's just describing how you array your organization to benefit from uncertainty. Okay. And then the second one is a book called Super Forecasters. One of the guys called Tetlock. I'm trying to remember the other authors. It's two authors. And the reason why it's like there are patterns to predicting the direction of travel where things, and particularly what I used to give a talk about megatrends, which are trends that are kind of inevitable that we've seen span multiple generations and they just keep going. Right. So I think being very aware of what the megatrends are. And then how to capitalize on uncertainty. Well, so anyway, that's why I would recommend those.
Yeah. What's your superpower, David?
Not sure if I have one superpower. I think I'm kind of a pretty good generalist. I think I'm quite good at taking a scrappy, you know, something from basically nothing and getting it to a point. So like getting a business off the ground. Like I've done it a number of times. I like that scrappy nature. Zero to one, yeah. I think that's something that I do quite well.
Can I just, he's underselling himself. He got us to €1 million ARR with a weird model, no sales and marketing budget. Like, it's incredible.
Literally, zero to one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, so anyway.
Your superpower is 0 to 1 million. I'll take that.
Yeah. I'd say team building, right? Because ultimately, I believe all problems, even in this intelligence era, are human capital. Okay. I think across different businesses, anything I've done that's good or clever has been due to a team of brilliant, brilliant people. And we've so many strong people in Outman. And I think that like we've kind of gone away from that a bit. But ultimately, so my big thing has always been good at spotting human capital and then motivating it, which is inherently team building.
Okay. What's your daily habit for success?
Taking care of myself.
Exercise.
Perfect. They're the kind of answers I love. What would you do today if it could be 10 million?
My CTO will shoot me if I don't say invested in Outman.
That's the obvious answer. Yeah. Or you can be creative and give me something different.
No, I give it. So basically, I have two brilliant, brilliant friends. And particularly this guy, because I have a guy called Jim McBride and another guy called Saul Griffith, who are the founders of a heroic or courageous engineering company called Other Lab in San Francisco, right? So what they so they also have a sort of a think tank or a sort of lobbying group called Rewiring America. So I think if you have children like we do, it's all about climate change, right? So basically what those guys have a track record of doing is taking things that have no efficiency, have no climate-friendly products and things like that. And over years, so again, back to who's done it multiple times in the commercial space, these guys have released, you know, incredible, they've done heat pumps, they've done air-driven solar tracking units and things like that. They've done wind energy done by kites really high up in the air, all sorts of crazy offshore wind platforms, things of that nature.
10 million into Other Labs.
Yeah.
David?
I do something completely, if I'm very honest with this, like I'd probably look after my family and set myself and my kids up for kind of financial certainty into the future. I think one of the downsides of working in the type of industry and the type of company that we are is that, you know, you make some financial sacrifices, there's a lot of financial uncertainty. So the thought of being financially stable for the rest of my life and my kids be okay, like that's very appealing to me, to be honest. So that's the honest answer to what I do.
Good. I can give you 1 million euro, invest in one person or one company only. Who?
Maybe mine's a bit of a risk to buy, because I heard him on the radio on at the weekend, but I think I'd put it in Man Aero. Like, I just, like, you know, it's insane some of the stuff that they're doing. They've just done 3 big partnerships with the, and I don't know them, I have no affiliations or whatever, but like the, I just think it's inevitable. They're competing on the world, at a world level against Google. They're way ahead of Amazon. Like, it's just, I can't see how you wouldn't get a good return out of your, even if the entry price is quite expensive.
I find it hard to believe that won't be a monstrous success.
Yeah.
He is exceptional.
Mm. That's totally Irish.
I'm definitely going with you on that one.
Yeah.
So back on the team building point, there's a bunch of incredible people we have in Outman, right?
Just give me one. It's 1 million to one person. Give me one.
Okay, well, actually, 1 million to one person. Okay, I hate to say that. I would actually say Zach Donnelly in Outman, who's my chief of staff.
What's he going to do with it?
I have no idea. He'd do really clever. Yeah.
Okay. What do you believe other people would find strange or strongly disagree with?
There seems to be, and we were talking about it before, right? Like this notion of, you know, the working hours the thing I probably, it's a bit weird where I feel that, like, I've had kids since starting a business, right? And I actually think it's been a good thing for me in the entrepreneurial journey while starting Outman, because, you know, yes, it's tough and you got to work kind of long hours and all that kind of stuff. But when you have kids they have to force you away from the work. So I have to, like, I try and finish work at the same time every day to spend a bit of time with them before they go to bed. You know, I'm kind of one of those people where I kind of need to be taken from the desk, right? And I feel that, like, we're 5 years in now. If I didn't have that bit of balance on the outside of in my family side, well, then I'd probably get burned out quite quickly. I'd find it probably in the last place that I worked, I got a bit burned out. So I think it also helps you focus, prioritize, you know, so I think
good
it's
pressure.
Actually a good thing, having kids when you're doing startup land.
I like that. They're the kind of answers I like. Yourself?
So I'm like a factory for this stuff, but given it's an AI conversation, I would say all the conversation about is it sentient, is it AGI, is it ASI, unhelpful nonsense. Just not how it works. I think it distracts from the reality, and I think it's kind of a waste of time. So yeah, there's a lot of conversation about that I just don't understand, where it's like philosophy, I guess.
I would agree. There's a lot of, like, it's evil, it's going to take over the world. The amount of times I've heard that, I'm like, don't think your calculator is going to kill you, Kevin.
No, it's 60 minute tasks going to 10 minute tasks, and what does that imply for the world?
Yeah,
that's the conversation I like.
Exactly.
Yeah,
the realities. That's why I kind of dug into it with you at the start. What's been your worst investment? And you can give me your worst and your best investment together.
I haven't made them. I haven't made any investments, to be honest. I think
they can be money or time, yeah, or otherwise.
I think, to be honest, right, one of the things that I do regret is that I did a generalist business degree in university, and I didn't do something specific like in accounting or engineering or something. So I think, like, all the business Everything that I've learned in business has been through like real life, right? It's been through like we're in the workforce. It's, you know, out there kind of, through lived experience, let's say. So I do think sometimes if I had, you know, actually in the Outman context, it'd be handy if I had got a degree in accounting, which
your
I didn't.
Best investment?
I think like probably resisting the allure of the big tech sales job, especially being in a place like Dublin where it, you know, it's very appealing for people. And I've hired a lot of people who into startups that have gone on to the big tech companies. And I've always resisted it. Like I'm 10 years back in Dublin now. And I think that, look, I'm glad now that I have, because I feel that, you know, it's the experience that I've had and all that I've learned through working with various startups, it puts me in a really good position, I found, for going forward. So I'm thankful that I've resisted.
Cool. Ross.
So worst investment, anything that brought no way. So earlier in my career, I get like hot tips from friends. It's probably statute of limitations has passed. So it's basically failed insider trading. Lost money on insider trading.
Cheers. Like just all this coming. Yeah, yeah, up.
My mate works in a company. Okay. Oh, yeah, you got to do this. And okay. The point was I knew nothing about it. I learned nothing. So it's just a waste of time and everything, just a complete waste. So I hate that. I've never done it since. Then best, like I gotta say, my family. Like I think everything I do is enabled by my family, right? So that's a time investment. But if I look at capital investment, and again, I know this is probably a bad answer, but it is Outman, right? And like one of the things is I only invest in myself really because I like having skin in the game. Mm. I like taking on real risk and stuff like that. So ultimately, passive investment, if I can't get involved, if I can't roll up the sleeves, it's just not that interesting to me.
Okay, I want to give you to leave people one insight. I always say advice, but I think it's more important, like people get an insight or an action or advice. Just one thing you want people listening to take away. What is it, Ross?
Care deeply about being factual and understanding the reality around you. And I think every week I see passing at the moment, that becomes more important.
David.
Mm. I think especially for entrepreneurs at the early stage of business, like perfection is the enemy of good. I know it's a cliche nearly at this stage, but like reality, like somebody earlier in my career told me, you know, if you're 80% certain or you're 80% happy, just go, right? And just do it. So that's one of the things that I always remember.
Where can people learn more about yourselves and Outman?
Online on our website, outman.io. We're both on LinkedIn. Not big social people, mate, really. So, but they're the two key areas.
Yeah, it's a great article in The Currency that covers a lot of what we're doing. Irish Times covered us, but yeah, pretty much website's probably best.
They've just got the full inside scoop here. They need to go else. But if you're going to go somewhere, go to The Currency. The lads are exceptional.
Yeah,
lads, that was superb. Thank you so much.